This is episode 4 of the Rhode Island Liberty Report. In this episode, we take a little bit of a break from the format, and we have a guest in the studio, Bill Hunt from District 68, ran for state rep in the general election, and he's here to discuss the recent developments in Bristol and Warren. Hope you enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report, your source for libertarian commentary on current events in the Ocean State and Southern New England. Coming to you from Rothbard Studios, here are your hosts, Mike and Eric.
Welcome to the Rhode Island Liberty Report from libertyri.com. I'm Mike, and in the studio today with me is my co-host, Eric.
How's everybody doing out there? How you doing, Mike?
Good, good. We also have a special guest here in the studio with us today, candidate and libertarian from District 68, Bristol Warren, Bill Hunt. How you doing, Bill?
Doing great. Thank you guys both for having me. I really appreciate it.
Great. Thank you. So a lot in the news in District 68 lately, and we're kind of going to break format a little bit this week, and instead of doing a list of topics, we're just going to kind of cover that because that's a whole hour in and of itself. So
we've got Billy Hunt for the hour.
Yes, yeah, we'll do a deep dive into what's going on there. And I mean, it's just been so much, and I guess we should probably just start with what precipitated all of this. The whole, you know, Billy's opponent, Lofton Asensio, in the general election, coming out and being discovered, I should say, by the Warren Town Democratic Committee. Is that the proper organization? Right. Yeah. Discovering that he had some discrepancies in his campaign finance.
I think the big story that came out yesterday, actually, so man, it's amazing how fast these things can turn.
Thursday, you know what I mean? Right? We're recording Thursday.
Wow. So, so we're recording on Thursday, and this happened, came out yesterday. So basically what happened, right, Bill, and correct me if I got any of the story wrong, is that the Lofton was... had told a bunch of people in the Warren Democratic committee who were candidates that he was going to do a mailer for them, right, and send it out and everything. And then he kind of he told them that he did it, but he didn't really do it, and they were suspicious. And I don't know, maybe you can.
Well, the candidates in question are the four town council candidates, Democratic endorsed town council candidates for the town of Warren. They had supported Lofton's campaign throughout his primary into the general election. And during that campaign, Lofton had promised them a in-kind donation in the form of a mailer endorsing the entire Democratic slate to be mailed out to approximately 400 or 500 residents in the town of Warren. So that was the promise. That's what Lofton had said he had done. He's told the candidates and the town committee by extension that he did send out the campaign mailer. And why this is all coming out now, about 30 days after the election, is because in the process of filing their campaign finance reports, as required by law, they need to file the fact that they received an in-kind donation from Lofton Asensio. So in the course of them trying to get that information from him, this is how everything came out.
I see. So, I mean, a politician not keeping his promise, that's not exactly a huge shock, right? But it seemed like the real sketchiness of this whole thing was him forging documents and mocking up invoices. And, you know, and what I've heard in the media the last couple of days about this whole thing is, and everyone keeps using the word mistake. Oh, he made a mistake. It's whoops. You know, like, no, it wasn't a mistake that the kid made, right? This is very intentional, right? I mean, when you're mocking up invoices and you're creating phony copies of checks and different things, in order to intentionally defraud people so that you can convince them that you did something you didn't actually do. And now you're putting the not only those individuals in a position, right, where they have to file campaign reports that would have ended up being false, but now you also got the print shop involved, right, who gets a phone call and says, hey, did you do this? And they're like, no, we don't know what you're talking about. So now he's also defrauding the print shop, a local small business, you know, who he's supposed to be supporting, right? I mean, and the idea that people are just talking about this like it's a mistake, like a big whoops, and you see people using this language all the time, you know. And that's why I'm glad that I've seen you're one of the people who has really been extremely forceful and consistent in saying, look, this is not a mistake. This is very intentional, but also it's a pattern of behavior here. This is not the only instance of lying and deceit that's gone on with this kid. Is that right?
Right, right. Well, in the campaign, Bill, we talked about this in our very first episode,
that's right.
The election wrap up episode. You were, calling people's attention to his deceptions early on. You know, it wasn't just this is a pattern, right? This is now it becomes obvious what was going on, right?
Well, obviously nobody lives in an ivory tower. Nobody is, a saint by any means. But I like to think that I ran my campaign as honest and as straightforward as I could. And one of the goals that I had of my campaign was basically calling balls and strikes. I'm not going to sit out here and I had been accused of calling him a liar. But when in fact on the campaign, I did not accuse him of anything. I did pretty much like I'm doing now, which I'm sure we'll touch upon later. But I laid out the facts. His campaign had put out there that he had made a portion of his income from commercial diving for quahogs, commercial shell fishing. I had contacted the DEM and inquired about his status as a commercial shell fishing, and lo and behold, he didn't have a commercial shell fishing license. I went ahead and pulled his campaign finance disclosure with the Rhode Island Ethics Commission, and there showed no income received, 1099 W-2, any type of income received from shell fishing. Now, again, I'm not here to accuse him one way or the other, but it asked the question, if you don't have a shell fishing license and you're not reporting any income on your ethics filing, well, what does that say about your story? What does that say about you as a candidate? And what are you trying to hide, or what are you trying to appropriate to say the fact that you are a commercial shell fishing? I mean, I grew up working in the shell fishing industry. I worked my way through college for a seafood delivery company. These are hardworking individuals. People like to associate with them because it kind of fits his image of a hardworking, local boy from Bristol, which just really is not true.
Well, I think what was so, and I watched that debate when you kind of presented that, all those LA information, and something I didn't really think about until you just said it, but you really did kind of just say, look, this information is not, there's no 1099 here. It doesn't say you made any income. You don't have a license. What's going on?
I asked him to explain himself.
Explain yourself, right? And you didn't actually accuse him of any wrongdoing. And I think what gets forgotten here too is that his original answer was that he was in some apprentice program, or that he was, he got flustered and gave some kind of answer, which then later on when he talked to the paper, when he gave this long interview with the paper, it was a totally different story than even that.
Yep. And kudos to the paper too, because, he said the apprenticeship program, and then they followed up with me about that. I gave my opinion about the apprenticeship program, which I couldn't find a lot of information online. There was an age restriction to whether or not you could be a part of the apprenticeship program. And they actually did some good reporting over at the Warren Times Gazette, where they actually questioned him about his actually having a certification to be able to dive. Not that that's required. I mean, you can go down there and dive, but it actually opens up, to small businesses. You can open up liability for these organizations that fill diving tanks, because if you fill a diving tank for someone that doesn't have a license to dive, it could open up a big liability for you, because you basically enable them to go potentially hurt themselves underwater.
Well, interesting from a libertarian perspective, right? That's why you have organizations like PADI and I believe NAWI and
right.
I'm a certified diver. I did it when I was in high school. I used to dive for quahogs on the side as a, I had a student shell fishing license. It was enough money to give me gas money on the weekends and whatnot. That's a civilian qualification that is then honored by private businesses to whether or not they'll fill your tanks or sell you gear. If I remember right, there was certain gear they wouldn't sell you as well. Unless you showed a, and it's been so many years now, I could be a little bit off.
And it works pretty well.
It works beautifully.
And right. From an insurance perspective, as an insurance agent, I can tell you that this is underwriting guidelines that the insurance companies require that you're not doing this to prevent that opening them up from liability. So this is another free market situation where an insurance company is providing you with preferential rates by forcing or encouraging you to have people only with the certifications be selling gear to and filling tanks for. The other thing, just to be clear, you can recreationally fish for quahogs up to 2 pecs as long as you don't sell them. And that's what the distinction is with this.
That's correct. Yeah. No, good point there. And
so one thing I was wondering is what made you initially think to look into this in the first place, the whole quahogging thing and his whole livelihood and everything? Like, what was it that precipitated that? Was it a feeling you had? Was it just a gut feeling? Was it something about the way he was telling his story that just didn't make sense to you?
Well, the line I used in the article is the proverbial fish story. I mean, everything about this individual's background, his story, what he said very early on in the campaign, back June, May, I think it was even May before he even announced his candidacy, which is another story. But he sent out a letter to everyone in the district, and my wife got one. So it showed up in my mailbox, and it was a 4-page letter, which was very similar to his bio that was on his website, which talk about this, you know, hard knock life where he grew up in the mean streets of Bristol, which I'm still looking for myself. It's a pretty very nice town to grow up in. But again, not to disparage or to question his upbringing, because everybody has struggles and, you know, everybody has their own unique circumstance. But the whole story itself just didn't add up. And, you know, and again, I'm calling balls and strikes here. I'm not sitting here trying to say that, oh, he's lying, but it just didn't add up. So I took some of the specifics in his story, like the fact that he dove for quahogs to make a living. I question where he gets the remaining of his income, because here's somebody that's saying that they're looking to end influence from lobbyists in the state house, yet he gets the majority of his income, if not all of his income, as a paid lobbyist for special interest groups. And he also talked about stuff he advocates for, paid sick leave and raising the minimum wage. And here he is claiming that his first job was at 12 years old, getting paid $2 an hour. Now, I can't remember what the specifics were, but I'm 10 years older than he was. So when I was 22, the minimum wage was a lot higher than $2 an hour. So here's an individual who's advocating for a higher minimum wage, where he's, if he didn't have, according to his story, the opportunity to work for $2 an hour, his family may have not made rent, wouldn't be able to pay for the oil for their furnace, you know, on and on and on. So the hypocrisy was just amazing.
That's almost a picture perfect example of why the minimum wage is what it is so horrible, right? You know, it creates a barrier for people who, you know, might have limited skills to at least get something and then potentially learn and increase their skill set and go further.
Yeah, right? It's amazing to me. And this is another thing you brought up in the debate. You made this point about his job and the minimum wage. And it's like the whole idea that, you know, a guy could approach go up to a business owner looking for a job and say, hey, I'm looking for a job. Can you hire me? And the business owner can say, you know what? I can't really afford to hire anyone else right now because I got to pay him $15 an hour and I just can't afford it. And the guy says, well, I really need a job. I'll work for 10. And if that business owner says, okay, sure, I'll hire you for 10. He's a criminal. I mean, the whole if you look at it that way, the whole concept is ludicrous. So you're basically telling these people, no, you know what? You can't work for $10 an hour. It's actually unfair to the worker because he wants to work for that $10 an hour. Who are you to tell him he can't work for $10 an hour? It's crazy. And this is, and look, and I think that, you know, again, it's an instance where with this kid, it's like, it's all about the story. It's all about, you know, the changing his last name so that it fits the ethnic makeup of the town, right? To a Portuguese last name or whatever. And it's like the policies and the issues, everything is just so paper thin.
So something I thought was interesting when I went to that, to the second debate, and I watched that. And of course he came after you, and attacked the libertarian platform, essentially, right? And he threw a couple things out there. I think one was gun control, the other was Social Security and whatnot. And of course, in those debates, which are horrible from a time perspective, these are complex topics, right? So you can't respond to, for example, Social Security, right? That's not even an issue for a local candidate, right? So it shouldn't even be a problem.
Not at all.
Because you're not
right.
going to influence that at the state house.
Actually, I'll disagree with you. Social Security is a very important issue for the local candidates in Rhode Island, because as a candidate for Rhode Island, I would try to pass legislation where the state wouldn't tax your Social Security.
Well, that's a good point.
Okay. I think it is a big issue.
That's a good point. but they're not going to take it away from you, right?
It's that's not the like, tax on the Social Security, not the Social Security itself necessarily. Yes. But yes,
yeah.
You're right.
Yeah. It's not David Cicilline at the spaghetti dinner at the old, you know, the assisted living place saying they're going to take your money, right? But the point of the libertarian platform, and we got time here, we can talk, at least from my perspective, is we know, and I've not looked at the data lately, but we know it's going to run out, right? Everybody, there's a projected date that's going to just die, right? So the libertarians see this, right? And they're trying to say, look, we need to be thinking ahead and coming up with an idea, like a solution to this problem, you know? And you know, it's just, but again, he throws out the, they're going to take your check, you know, BS argument at a debate where you have no time to really defend that.
It's all sizzle and no stick. There's no substance to any of what he was saying. And again, that was part of my what I attempted to do in the debates was to show that he really doesn't have any ideas. He's just hitting all the Bubs words and he's articulate. He's, you know, a bright young kid. And you say to yourself, well, you know, hey, let's vote for him. Why not? We need some change up at the state house. And look at this. He's a Democrat and everything. And when it actually boils down to it and you look to it, the progressive movement that's going on in the state and across the country, these aren't Democrats. These are a virus, a cancer, a plague that is on the Democratic Party. They have hijacked the party for their own purposes. They are moving the agenda and the platform of the Democratic Party, especially in Rhode Island, so far left that it's nothing compared to what the Kennedy Democrats of my grandparents saw when they were running the state and when they were in charge. And I think that people just need to realize that this is not the Democratic Party of the past. This is a new, scary, socialist Democratic Party of the future.
For sure. Yeah. And, you know, just going back a little bit on your story, I think something that at least keyed in on me was that when he was telling his story, the one you were talking about that seemed a little too Norman Rockwell, if you will, he's made statements in the past about how Democrats should run. And it should be all about their story because people will connect with their story
as opposed to their policies. RI Future article, or interview that you gave. Right.
I mean, that's social engineering, right? You're trying to influence people's emotions and appeal to their emotions as opposed to running on, like, Bill's campaign, which was, maybe we'll get a little bit of that, what his main points were, which, if I recall, were lowering taxes, making it more business-friendly. You know, if you want to talk a little bit about that, Bill, before we go on.
Yeah. You know, he did cut his teeth on the Obama campaign, which I think is where he got a lot of that, story over substance, idea from. It's unfortunate that it was a lot of the campaign did devolve into these, you know, silly stories about co-hogging. And I know a lot of people think it's not important when you talked about politics. And the reason why I did bring it up, because I thought it spoke to his character. But I would have much rather spent the time talking about the issues that were important to me, including, you know, small business regulations. I'll be having a meeting with the Rhode Island Secretary of State if they don't cancel it on me after all this happens. But next Wednesday, to talk about some reforms in the annual reports. I did an article in Go Local about the struggles that small businesses have and the crazy regulations that are out there that seem innocuous when they get passed by legislators. But when practiced, it can throw a company into chaos and create tons of extra work and really put not only the business owner, but the business itself in jeopardy by suspending their ability to operate as an LLC or a corporation in the state, which opens up a whole other can of worms. I talked about lowering taxes. We talked about the Social Security tax. Another big issue with me was eliminating the tax on the military benefits, retired military. We have a great Naval War College in Newport. There are people who are stationed in Rhode Island, and they go ahead and they come here, they get to know the place, they retire, and then they go to settle here and they realize, well, the state's going to tax your military benefits. And again, I'm out of practice. It's been a whole month since the campaign. Sure. But it's the majority of the states either don't tax income at all, which would be great in Rhode Island. I think there's 9 states total that don't tax the things. But I think there's another 23 or so, I want to say, that don't tax military benefits. California doesn't tax military benefits, which is, I mean, you know, talk about a tax-heavy state. But what ends up happening, and the key to that is that most people, when they retire from the military, they have a 2 or 4 year degree paid for by the federal government. And it's not these degrees in women's studies or, you know, gender issues or whatever, art history or, you know, communications. These are in-demand skills that they learned in the military to work on, ships to, you know, we have electric boat right here that's dying for employees to come work there. And so here is an opportunity where we could say, hey, listen, let's eliminate the tax, get these people to stay in Rhode Island, attract people from other states that do tax it. Hey, come to Rhode Island. Immediately, we fill the jobs, the in-demand jobs that we can't get people who are trained for. We don't have to make the Rhode Island promise because, you know, quite frankly, why are we going to pay for someone to go to school and on a to get an associate's degree without these in-demand jobs when we can just say, hey, let's take that money, apply it to lowering or eliminating the tax on military benefits, and we already get those people anyway. It's crazy. And these are the type of issues that I wanted to talk about. But again, when you're up against someone who is, you know, free everything and, you know, $15 minimum wage, single payer health care, social justice, it's tough to have these type of conversations because they're constantly driving the conversation in towards those social issues. Right.
I think we all wish there was more substantive conversation in these elections. But I do think at the same time, I think that if anything, you bringing up this whole issue with his employment, and the discrepancies, it's all been proven to be pretty spot on in terms of reflective on his character, given the news that came out recently. I mean, and I think when we're talking about giving people the kind of power to dip into people's pocketbooks, to arrest them and to take away their freedom and to the kind of power to write legislation that takes, someone who's a drug dealer, you know, who sells drugs to someone who ODs and then putting them in jail for life, you know, that's incredible power. And so character is an incredibly important aspect of what it means to be given that responsibility. And so I don't think you should sell yourself short in terms of the importance of bringing that up. I think you would have, obviously, I think we'd all rather you guys be talking about things like the veterans tax benefits and everything.
Well, that's become an issue. You see in all the comments and you see it everywhere about we need to find the right person. You know, so now everybody's starting to realize now, it seems, when Bill was beating the drum that, okay, well, now all of a sudden it's important because this guy's been found out. Well, where were you a couple months back? It almost has to take a crisis to get people to pay attention and open their eyes and start realizing that, no, we need to elect people not based on, you know, again, emotional stories, but based on actual substance. And
that was the other thing that I was trying to get across in my campaign is that you got to look at the qualifications of the individual that's running for the office. And would you hire them for a job? Now, again, a 25-year-old doesn't have the life experience and as demonstrated by, understanding the consequences of his actions by doing something as silly as, you know, making a fraudulent invoice and a canceled check to cover up the fact that you didn't send out a mailer just speaks to the fact that someone doesn't understand the consequences of his actions and what could actually happen as a result of that. The other thing is that, you know, you're electing someone that hasn't had a real job in his entire life. Now, I'm sure he worked hard. I'm sure he, you know, was a very good political consultant or a lobbyist or whatever he was getting paid for by the organizations he was working for. But you want someone at the state house that understands, you know, who's a taxpayer. I own a home in the district. I pay taxes in the district. I pay I have a full-time job, 1099 income for my commissions. I'm an insurance salesperson. I work with small businesses on a daily basis. I learn and I hear about the struggles that they have dealing with the state, which is part of the reason why I brought up the issue with the Rhode Island Secretary of State in the annual reports. These are the type of issues that you want someone up there. Far too many of the elected officials that we have at the state house, it's such a common theme. They're lawyers. They are retired police and firefighters. And nothing, there's nothing wrong with that. They're retired school teachers. Again, nothing wrong with that. But again, they're noble professions. But when you get those people up at the state house and they don't have the life experience and they don't understand the issues and the needs of the small business owner and the everyday taxpayer and the person that, you know, doesn't have longevity and doesn't have a union to back them up, if they do something stupid and someone wants to, you know, fire them or, you know, whatever, there's a reason why these people are struggling and, they need to be, the empathy needs to be there from the elected officials for sure.
Yeah, for sure. And there needs to be balance, right? I mean, it's not, there's a demographic, it's a segment of our society, right? Those people that are there, you know, but there also needs to be others as well. And there needs to be opposition too, you know, and that's sadly lacking in the state house. And as a libertarian, you know, do you see that as an opportunity, or, you know, what are your thoughts on that? Maybe the question is why a libertarian instead of a, you know, independent or a Republican?
Well, I'm running as a libertarian, and I have run as a libertarian because I am a libertarian. There's no pretense. There's no anything other than that. Someone who runs as an independent, they could be a far left independent. They could be a far right independent. They could be some crazy person that has some, you know, anarchy or some crazy thing in mind that is not really transformed or put across in there in the independent label. The libertarian platform, you can look up at the platform and I can say that I agree with, you know, 95% of everything that they have to say. So I most closely align with what they say. You take the progressive movement, on the other hand, where they don't align with the Democratic Party, in my opinion, what their core values are, what they used to be. And here they are taking over that party and camouflaging themselves. And I mean, we have this problem in Rhode Island all the time. How many people are elected up at the state house that are Democrats, but in any other state, they would be a Republican? And there's this idea in Rhode Island that you can't win as anything except for a Democrat, so you might as well just run as a Democrat. But that's just a flawed argument, because now once you get up into that big tent in the state house, and we have a Speaker of the House that has, by the nature of the rules, has so much power that he's dictating all legislation and the who's chairing the committees and, what legislation comes out, what gets on the calendar. And now if you disagree with him or you vote against something that he has, you're in political Siberia and you're not going to get your legislative grants. Oh my God, your town's, you know, your little league's not going to get the $2,000 for the new turf on the field. So the only thing that you can do really effectively for your district is to, you know, play ball with the Speaker to get those little legislative grants. And hopefully you have a Speaker in power that's going to drive legislation this to have the state in the right direction. You can argue one way or the other with the past couple speakers we have about how effective they've been doing that. But the system is broken, and that is something that I think needs to be reformed. And the only way you're going to do that is by having, you know, different caucuses up there. And I believe that a Libertarian caucus would be a perfect fit for the state, because the Republican caucus, has such I don't know even what to call it. It's not a reputation. It's just an impotence of effectiveness in the state house, and they've had so much time to build a party and to do something, and they haven't. So I think it's just time for a new direction.
Man, put that on a bumper sticker,
right?
Impotence, yeah, of effectiveness.
That's
perfect. I think one thing you said in terms of these leftists masquerading as Democrats, it kind of brings us to our next topic, which is this Working Families Party, right? Which is a third party, basically, that has decided strategically that they aren't going to run as a third party, but they are going to try to basically infiltrate the Democratic Party. Now, before we get to that, though, I do want to just make sure that we mention, in case anyone hasn't been following the news, that Lofton Asensio has decided to not take his seat. And that was a later development. And there is going to be a special election. Billy Hunt, are you running?
Oh, of course.
You are. Okay.
I have the signs already.
Okay, good. We just wanted to make, I had to make sure we got that on tape, that you are running once again for this seat. I think anyone out there listening who is sympathetic to libertarian values, Billy needs your help. And this is a second chance here at really getting some good representation for the Bristol Warren area.
So that feeling you felt the day after the election, when in the pit of your stomach, when you realized it was a progressive, a hardcore progressive that got elected, now's your chance to redeem yourself and support somebody who has actual values and is going to do a good job. I have no doubt in my mind.
Absolutely. Now, I want to get to the other news that actually just broke today, is that you filed a complaint with the Board of Elections. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. This is something that I'm trying my best not to be accusatory. I'm not trying to say that this is 100% fact and that I know this to be true 100%, because the only information I'm going on is what's on public record. So I'm already handicapped a little bit because I don't have all of the information. I just have what was reported. It's something that the limited resources that I have in terms of, you know, working a job, responsibilities for my family, getting some sleep, hopefully, these are things that, it prevents the average everyday person from doing this type of stuff. And that's why, I think to backtrack a little bit, we need someone at the State House that could be a watchdog for the district, that could be a watchdog for the entire state, I have an intuition and calling balls and strikes, and something that I see, I can kind of call BS on and say, that doesn't seem right to me. And to that, point, what had happened was in the course of the campaign, as I was reviewing campaign finance reports of my opponent and a few other organizations that were supporting my opponent, I began to notice some discrepancies in terms of in-kind donations that were made by a political action committee known as the Rhode Island Working Families Party Political Action Committee that were being made to my opponent specifically, that were not matching the expenditure on the PAC's campaign finance report and the donation on my opponent's finance report. It wasn't a lot. It was kind of a weird anomaly, and I kind of like didn't really know what to make of it. And, I believe it was a small amount. I'm looking at my notes here. It was, maybe $60 or so. But as I started to dig into it a little bit more, I began to realize that there was a lot of inconsistency, not just with my opponent, but with a number of additional opponents. And back when the last campaign finance report was filed, it was December 4th, so just a few days ago, just as this point, again, as this point was coming out because people were trying to file their campaign finance reports, I had this in the back of my mind. And now that I had all the information for the entire election season, I really started digging through some stuff with a fine-tooth comb. And what I found was there's a lot of in-kind donations that the Political Action Committee claims that they made to candidates that the candidates did not report on their finance reports. And even more, there's a lot of donations that the candidates are saying that they're getting from Rhode Island Working Families Party that Rhode Island Working Families Party doesn't have on their campaign finance reports. And again, what does that mean? I don't know, but I'm here to ask the question. I'm here to say, why is this the case? Right. And that's why I gave it over to the Board of Elections to let them make that decision, because that's what they get paid for.
Yeah. And we've talked, pre-show when we just talked in chat, and you're not a forensic accountant. So, and like you said, you don't have access to all the information, but there's obvious inconsistencies that need to be explained, right? So maybe there is a proper explanation, and that will come out in an investigation and
Could you maybe talk about a little of the specifics in terms of how much money we're talking about here? Who are the candidates that we're talking about? Is it something that really could just come down to a breakdown of communication where they got their wires crossed, or is it, do the numbers sort of tell a different story?
Sure. I mean, again, I'm not trying to be accusatory. This is how I see it, is that the total transactions in total is between, $5,800 and $6,800, depending on what you want to link into this. And I'll break that down for you. About a little over $3,400 are donations reported by Rhode Island Working Families Party, but not reported by the candidates. Just under $2,400 was reported by the candidates, but but not reported by the Working Families Party. So the ledgers don't match. It's on one side of the ledger, but it's not on the second side of the ledger. And that's what caught my attention. The last donation in question was an in-kind donation that was reported in the calendar year 2017 by the candidate, but reported, it was December 29th by the candidate, and reported by Rhode Island Working Families Party as January 1st, 2018. And the reason why that's important is this is for Aaron Regenberg's campaign. And the reason why that's important is because you're only allowed to receive $1,000 from a political action committee in a calendar year. So again, this may be a clerical error. There may be something, that was just a miscommunication. It may be an honest mistake. But the amount of transactions that are included in my research lead me to believe that this is an ongoing, a more systemic issue than just, the handful of accounts that I actually found. So digging into it a little bit deeper, the suspected violations, again, I'm not accusing anyone, these are the suspected violations, is that Rhode Island Working Families Party knowingly omitted at least $2,400 in donations to candidates in their campaign finance reports. Six candidates included, and the ones that they are is Asensio, the small one that I found on him, Janine Coughlin, who I believe is District 30 rep, Aaron Regenberg, who I mentioned earlier, Marsha Rangel Vassell, who is a Providence rep, Michael Steiner, and forgive me, his was another small one that was an anomaly, but again, I just wanted to put it all out there, everything that I found, and Moira Walsh, who had a handful of donations as well. But the implications of this is that these candidates, Janine Coughlin, just on the ones that don't match up on the ledger, these aren't including the other ones that did match on the ledger that I didn't include in the complaint, but just on the ones that matched on the ledger, she knowingly accepted $1,131 of in-kind donations from the Rhode Island Working Families Party, just on these discrepancies. There's other ones for some of these candidates that were in addition to these. Regenberg, if you throw in that $1,000 donation that is reported in 17, 18, depending on how you look at it, is $1,499, so $1,500 in donations. And Maura Walsh has just over $1,000 if you count her in-kind donations. Again, it's indiscriminate. It's not a huge overage. It's not like we're talking about, thousands of dollars of overage. But it's interesting how separate from one another, everyone's within the law and everyone's underneath $1,000 limit and, everything's reported, fine and well on the campaign reports. But when you start putting these together and you start adding up the figures, you start getting in-kind donations that are above and beyond that $1,000. And that's what raised my attention. That's why, again, I brought it to the Board of Election for them to decide on how they feel this should be handled.
So the idea is sort of that if everyone's right in their own reporting, right? Like if Working Families is right in everything that they reported and the candidates are right in everything that they reported, but they just omitted these payments for whatever reason, these donations from their own reports, then these things total more than the allowable $1,000 a year donation or whatever, which would be in violation of campaign finance law.
Exactly.
Right? Correct.
And we're talking about in-kind donations, and I can understand the thought process of, well, there may be a discrepancy about how you qualify an in-kind donation. I know, you're not qualifying every single volunteer that's, coming in and knocking on doors for you. But the key distinction with the Rhode Island Working Families Party, which is a very interesting wrinkle to this whole entire thing, is that they're not just having, any volunteer that, signed up on their website and showed up to knock on doors on any given day. They actually work with the national party and they have paid volunteers that come out and do canvassing for them, which is, there's the YAL, the Young Americans for Liberty, who's a group that's supportive of the Libertarian Party, do the same thing. So this is not an uncommon practice. But where it becomes sticky is that they have this this organization, it's a corporation, the Community Labor Services Administration Incorporated, that actually pays these canvassers to go out and work on campaigns. They may go collect index cards, get people to sign index cards that they can go, that people can deliver to, you know, sitting officials or elected officials so that they can pass certain legislation. They sometimes paid to attend political rallies that, you know, to make sure it looked like there's more people there and to have hold up signs and everything like that. So what it works out to is that these Working Families Party PAC in Rhode Island is making payments on behalf of these candidates to this corporation to pay for paid staff to work on their campaign. So when you're actually talking about paying a corporation for paid staff, there's really not a lot of room to say, well, it was just a way that we applied the in-kind donation. No, there should be a way to track that back and account for every single specific entry in your campaign finance report if you're actually paying that corporation on the back end.
Right. We're not talking about some, you know, some local shop owner who dropped off a bag of dinner rolls or something. We're, you know, we're talking about something very, you know, that's very trackable and should be very well documented.
Well, that's, I mean, I have people help me out on my campaign all the time. I mean, I had people volunteer, you know, to work on my Facebook page. I had a volunteer from June Speakman's class that helped me do that down in Roger Williams. You know, there's volunteer work where people who are coming up, and I understand that. That's fine. I encourage that. I encourage people to get involved in political campaigns and to, you know, offer, you know, services, you know, any way that you can to help out a candidate. You know, if you're not getting paid and it's of your own volunteer time, I think that's forgivable if there's some discrepancies in the campaign finance report, because how are you really going to attract that? But again, this is a in-kind staff time that's being furnished by a corporation. There should be no question about how that is being applied on these campaign finance reports. It should be to the dime, should work out.
And can PACs get help from corporations?
Well, that's a question too. I always thought that you can't have campaign contributions from corporations to a political action committee or a campaign. You know, again, that's something that is interesting when it comes to this type of expenditure, because, again, and this is something that hasn't been verified by the Board of Election or anything, and I'm not an expert and I don't know the circumstances surrounding it. But as the reports stand right now, all these payments to this corporation are payments in the form of a accounts payable on the balance sheet of the campaign finance charge. So this Rhode Island Working Families PAC is not actually making the payments as they are due to this corporation. They're going ahead and they're basically running up the credit card for, in this case, since 2017. I believe it's 17 months since they've actually paid back anything to this this corporation. And so the question becomes, and again, the question, not an accusation, the question becomes, at what point does an account payable actually become a loan? And can you accept a loan from a corporation?
Wow, that's a very good point.
Because the intent of an accounts payable is the short-term thing, right? You get an invoice, you know, or you know there's going to be an invoice coming, so you put it on accounts payable, you pay the invoice, next report, it comes off your accounts payable because it's been paid.
And so,
but they just keep building it and building it, right, building it and not paying.
Well, think of a credit card. Think of credit, right, card. Think about a invoice you'd receive from printing signs. I printed 100 signs to you, I'll send you an invoice.
And it wouldn't be illegal for a PAC to buy something from a corporation, let's say, nope, like staff services.
Yep.
But if they're not paying for it, And it turns out these tabs get run up and keep going on and on and on. It becomes more like a loan. Now you're talking about something totally different.
It becomes their form of dark money. And, you know how much the progressives go after other parties, whether it's Libertarian or Republican or whoever, about dark money spent when they're doing the same thing.
This is what it seems like.
The other question that it brings up and the other issue that it brings up is that when you have paid staff on your campaign, you should be able to look at the expenditures and know what staff people are being paid by your campaign to work on your campaign. When you're funneling the staff time through this corporation, you can't see who was hired to work on this campaign. It's only going back to this corporation in Brooklyn, New York. And then what are you supposed to do if you're trying to figure out who's supporting these individuals? So
Who is the director of the Working Families Party?
To be honest with you, there's been a lot of names going through my head.
What's her name?
Because I'll look it up. I saw her on an article the other day.
Did she have anything to say about any of this? Has she commented on Lofton's situation and And I'm just wondering what her name is, because I believe she was at the, Mike, was she at the thing at Rick, the public occurrences thing? Wasn't she on stage? I think she was.
I can tell you, before Lofton decided to resign, she was quoted in a tweet or an article somewhere saying that even though this was a horrible mistake, again, a mistake, I don't really know if that was the word for it, but even though it was a horrible mistake, that we need individuals like this in the State House for this political agenda. And the question then becomes then is that, you know, who are you willing to vote for and who are you willing to have represent you as long as they match your political agenda?
I mean,
agenda.
This whole ends justify the means thing is so dangerous. And we talked about this last week on the podcast, and the idea that, I mean, if he's willing to go to these lengths to hide the fact, right, that he, oh, man, he didn't get to doing this mailer, which honestly, what isn't that big a deal? Like, he could have just said, oh, you know, guys, I'm sorry, I didn't get to it. He's the rep elect. Like, what does he care at this point? He's already in. It wouldn't have been a big deal. If he's willing to go to these lengths to cover that up, I mean, what do you think he'd be willing to do to cover up something way, way worse? I mean, it's just like, it's like telling a small lie. It's like, if you want to lie about something tiny, I mean, you'd probably lie about something worse, right?
It's, again, it's, it goes towards his character, and we just don't need, we've had so many bad representatives in the district and in the state that I think that we need to have people with honesty and integrity that are up at the State House representing the people of District 68.
Right. And I think it's not even like it matters so much to me. Like you heard, Tara Granahan, I think, was talking about this, saying we need people with more experience, you know, and saying how Lofton, you know, he didn't have any experience. He wasn't an elected official. But I mean, there's plenty of people with tons of experience who've done way worse things. I mean, it's not like that's an end all be all. You really do have to look at the individual. And this kind of comes back to libertarian philosophy of getting out of this idea of groupthink. You know, this idea that, you know, if you give yourself some sort of a group label like progressive or Democrat or whatever, even libertarian, you really still have to look at the individual, right? And who is this person? What do they have to say? What, you know, what kind of character do they have? You know, all these other metrics, you know, oh, this person's well-liked, they're good-looking, they're, you know, they got a great story. I mean, it's like American Idol nonsense.
It is.
So I found the article. It's Georgia Hollister Isman, director.
Okay.
She says, I'm particularly let down because, where is it? Okay. As troubled as I am about Lofton's actions, I'm counting on his deeply held beliefs in equality and justice to move him past his poor judgment and towards delivering real change for his constituents and all Rhode Islanders.
Right.
Okay. And injustice is a good word. I think it's a little bit misplaced, I think, in that statement.
I would say so. I mean, and these people are all really good friends, right? They all know each other really well, which makes sense, right? Why they would. It's like, you know, they're all like-minded. I mean, the idea that there'd be this level of miscommunication between all of them about what was given, what wasn't given, what, you know, there's too many of them. It'd be one thing if there were like one or two discrepancies or three or even three or four discrepancies total. But I mean, looking at what you've got here, Billy, it looks like there's dozens.
I didn't count them much all together. But again, you know, this is, again, going back to the minimum wage issue that we were talking about before. These are all small amounts for paid staff time. And then the question has to become, how much are they actually paying their volunteers to work on their campaigns? And are they being paid a fair minimum wage? That's the question that I have for the Rhode Island
Working Families Party. That is a great
point.
Yeah.
Something tells me they're probably not making 15 an hour.
Yeah, I don't think that's happening.
Practice what you preach, right? You know, it's one of those things that you're gonna walk the walk. If you know, talk the talk, you should walk the walk.
Yeah. Well, was it Bernie that got caught?
Yeah, right. It was Bernie.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean, and actually, just to throw a little bit of national headline in there is this, you know, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, I guess.
Also part of the Working Families Party.
Working Family Party nationally, right? She came out and said that she was actually going to pay her interns $15 an hour. So she came out and said that, hey, you know, we got to walk the walk. That's great. Good job. Good luck.
Yeah.
I want to see how long that lasts before she starts, you know, cutting down her intern staff, because I'm sure she will.
Right. Yeah. So, we'll just have to wait and see, I guess, at this point. I'm sure there, maybe it'll get more, you know, more into the news cycle. Who knows how that will work out.
I mean, it seems like there's a lot here. Yeah. And I really got to commend you, Billy. This is a lot of work. I've done this kind of digging before in terms of campaign finance reports and going to the website. And it's not an easy site to navigate. It takes a lot of man hours to go through these reports. And so I mean, you've really done, you're doing God's work here, my young man.
Oh, thank you.
My good man.
And again, thank you. They don't make it easy. And I think that's kind of by design. And I know there's a lot of good folks that work at the Board of Elections, and they have to work within these systems themselves. So you really can't blame them specifically. But, the leadership in the state and the leadership in these departments, the best and the brightest, as Gina likes to call them, really need to top down from the Board of Elections to, the Division of Taxation to the Attorney General's office, another topic that has been in the headlines the last couple of days. They need to really take some accountability for their own actions and their own processes. And people need to wake up to the idea of the amount of waste and fraud. And I won't even call it fraud. It's just incompetence that goes on in these departments, not because of any of the state workers that work in those departments. It's just the system and the rules that they have to play by, just breeds incompetence. And that's how it is. The more regulations you have, the more convoluted it gets, the less customer service the constituents of the state have.
It kind of goes back to that point you made actually about small business, in the sense that having all these regulations, they have to keep up with all this paperwork. I know that someone who's connected to small business, I know that sometimes it gets to the point where you almost have to consider hiring someone just to deal with this stuff, because it's taking away from your ordinary everyday activities. So just I think we're getting close to wrapping up here.
Just one point I wanted to bring up was, this is just one organization. How deep does this rabbit hole go with other organizations that are similar?
Oh, that's...
We don't know.
Maybe I can take a
Bill's
month
only
off.
Got so many hours.
Take a month off of work.
There was an alphabet soup of new political action committees that were created in this 2018 election year that endorsed a lot of these candidates that never existed before. So I'm sure there's more to be uncovered.
And sometimes they have a registered address in Delaware or something like that. But just looking ahead, you are running. The election looks like it might be like 90 days from now, maybe, or something like that. But it looks like there's going to be a very crowded Democratic primary. There's already like four or five people that have declared something like that.
We've been at this almost an hour now, so there could have been four or five more people.
Right, exactly. So what can we expect going forward from your campaign? What do you have to say to people out there who might be listening, who might want to help out, might want to reach out to you? What's your message to people who might go back to the well during this election and vote for another Democrat?
Well, all right, a few things. First of all, Hope with Hunt, my website, my Twitter handle, everything. Search Hope with Hunt, hashtag Hope with Hunt, you'll find me easily. Number two, the crowded feel is very indicative to the politicians who are just opportunists, who are only looking to advance their own political career. They are not in it to help the district at all. If they were in it to help the district, they would have ran against Ken Marshall in 2016. When I ran against Ken Marshall in 2016, they would have ran against Loftus Asensio in the primary. Andy Tiska did. I welcome him back in the race. The other thing is that you have to understand that these special elections, they cost the district money. They cost the taxpayers money. It's crazy that we're not only going to have to pay for a special election, but we're going to have to pay for a special primary election too. So I challenge the Democratic District Committee in District 68 to get their act together and to nominate a candidate to run against me in the general election, because we shouldn't be wasting more. The Democratic Party got us into this mess. We shouldn't have to waste more taxpayer dollars to help them decide who the Democrat is that hopefully will get us out of this mess. The other thing is that the town council president, Joe DePasquale, just announced today that he's going to throw his hat in the ring, and he's an independent. So it should be a three-way race. I want to make the same challenge to him to step down as well, too, because if he wins as a sitting town councilman, there's going to have to be another special election to reelect a person to replace him as well. So we need to have politicians that aren't political opportunists to get into the race for the right reasons. Pick one Democrat. If a Republican wants to jump in, or an independent that doesn't already own a representative or a town council person or elected official, if they want to jump in, I welcome them. I question the intentions of all the others that are just jumping in to try to steal one in a special election.
And I'd be remiss if I didn't take this opportunity to just give a little message, a little shout out to all the other political parties out there. You could learn something from the Libertarian Party, who nominates all of its candidates without taxpayer money. Okay. Get your acts together, get rid of these primaries, figure out who you want to run from your party, and don't expect the taxpayers to pay for it. Pay for it yourselves. That's what I would say. So anyway, so it looks like we're just about to wrap up here. If you want to contact Billy to help him out, he gave you that information, Hope with Hunt.
Well, notes in the links in the show notes as well.
Link in the show notes. Excellent. And if you want to contact the podcast, of course, you can contact us at libertyri.com. You can find us on Facebook, LibertyRI, and Twitter, LibertyRI. We're very active on those social media platforms. So please contact us if you have any questions, if you want to engage with us. We love that. We've had a lot of it so far. We're really enjoying it. You can also get the podcast on pretty much every major podcast platform, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play. You can find us there. Leave us a review. Give us a rating. It really helps with the search results and things like that. And then if you want to email us, get in contact with us directly, you can email me at eric@libertyri.com or mike@libertyri.com. Thanks for listening. Thank you to Billy Hunt for being here. It's been really great to have this nice long form discussion with you about these issues. And we really look forward to seeing what happens in the next 3 months. It's very exciting. It's like Christmas all over again. Hopefully we won't end up with a lump of coal at the end.
Yeah.
We'll have a nice shiny new bike and it'll be very exciting. So, thanks for listening, everybody. We'll see you next time.
Take it easy.
You've been listening to the Rhode Island Liberty Report. Be sure to check us out at libertyri.com.